B-Pod Studios.
Today on Talkin' Rock with Meltdown.
Ivan Moody from Five Finger Death Punch is my guest today on the Talkin' Rock with Meltdown podcast. Their new record's called F8, or Fate. It's their eighth album, and Ivan credits the title to guitarist Zoltan Bathory.
If this is our eighth album, we're going to call it Five Finger Death Punch 8, but we're going to abbreviate it to F8.
We talk about the heaviness of this record, as well as the therapy to writing new music for a guy like Ivan.
Music has been the universal language for me, and has been therapy as well as a family member from as long as I can remember.
He does talk about how heavy this record is.
How do we want to go out this? And do we want to punch him in the face or just slap him on the butt? it was a no-brainer.
We talk about his newfound status as a grandfather, this CBD line, and if he thinks he's made it yet or not. Ivan Moody from Five Finger Death Punch is on Talkin' Rock.
This is Talkin' Rock. Talkin' Rock. Your backstage pass to some of your favorite rock artists. Here's your host, Meltdown.
Thank you so much for checking out the Talkin' Rock with Meltdown podcast. Lots going on. Man, just talked to Josie Scott yesterday about getting back in Saliva and what the time frame for that is. And this sobriety and everything. If you get a chance, go back and check that out. But today we've got a two-for-one. Once again, we've got Ivan coming up here first. We'll tell you about that in just a second. But first, John Wiederhorn is going to be up next. He's the author of this book called Raising Hell, Backstage Tales from the Lives of Metal Legends. This book is definitely worth getting, man. If you've ever wondered what happens backstage or what happens on the road or pranks they play or Spinal Tap moments of all sorts of rock stars, from the guys from Judas Priest to Megadeth to, you know, bands you may have never even heard of before. But John's going to be up second, say, talking about his book, and he's got some great stories. So definitely give it a listen right to the end of this podcast. But first, Ivan is up. Of course, their new record, F8 or Fate, is out right now. And we have a lot of stuff to get to. As if you follow Ivan on social media, especially on Instagram, he does post a lot of pictures, and he posted the other day about his grandchild being born. And so we'll talk about that, his sobriety, his CBD line, all sorts of stuff. But it's funny because the last time I interviewed Ivan was in person, and he wanted to do it on the lawn of our local, you know, 12,000 person venue after the doors had opened up. So you can kind of figure what kind of security risk this poses. But he was cool, man. He came out with his Detroit Lions jersey on in front of the fans and did that whole interview. And it was really cool, something I'll never forget. And logistically, it might have been a nightmare for security, but those guys were down. And so was Ivan. And that's where we start off the conversation today with the frontman from Five Finger Death Punch, Mr. Ivan Moody.
Well, hello.
How you doing, brother?
How are you, sir?
I'm doing good. Last time we talked, it was on the lawn. Do you remember that?
I was just talking to Jackie about that. I felt like I put you in a really awkward position, but fun as hell at the same time. Sorry about that, but not really.
You know what? It's one of those interviews I will never forget. It was like the first and only time I've ever done that, but it's so memorable, and it was so much fun for the fans. So, yeah, thanks for that. That was actually pretty cool. But, hey, before we get into the new record, I just want to say congratulations. I'm about 10 years older than you, and I am definitely not ready to be a grandfather yet, but you are. How's that feel?
Oh my God, am I? I keep having to question it. I'm like, dude, have I gotten there? But I guess I have. It's fantastic, man. I mean, it's to see. I call it legend versus legacy, my man. And it's really what you leave behind, and to know that, you know, my kids are coming to an age where they're having their kids. And well, let me take that back. This is the weirdest part. My youngest is 7 years old.
Oh.
So she's an aunt.
Right.
I'm just like, how did this even happen? You know what I mean? So it's cool, brother. I really dig it. But at the same time, not so willing to accept the grandpa term yet.
I know. Some people do. You probably see friends of yours that you went to school with and stuff. They're like flipping out over being grandparents. I'm like, I am not ready for that task just yet.
You know
yet,
what so. I mean? Yeah. I'm like, dude, you know, put it in check.
Yeah, we're too cool, man. We're in the rock and roll world. We can't be grandfathers yet, but
straight up, dude. I got L.A. years, man. I go back every birthday, so I'm not cool with it.
Right. So the new record dropped, of course. Fate, talk a little bit about this record, man. What do you want people to take away from it?
I want them to take away from what I put into it, man. This was an absolute morph. It was a modification of not only artistically, But, you know, as people, as individuals, especially for myself and Zoltan, you know, we started this band over 13 years ago, 14 years ago. So for us, it had gotten to a point where, let's just call a spade, the last couple albums, for me, they were a little bit stagnant. They were monotonous. It was something, there were definitely tracks I was very proud of, obviously, a couple of ones like I Refuse and Seasons Change, The Pride. I'm sorry, you know what I mean? There's Champagne,
yeah.
You know, but all in all, it just felt like we weren't doing ourselves any justice. And so I really went to the table on this one and said, listen, where have we been? Where are we now? And where the hell are we going, my man? Because this is either going to change or else we might as well just call it a day. So it was really going back to basics and having a new vision. It really encompasses where we are now. Which that's the appreciation of it for me, and I think the fans are going to love that part of it. It's not the same record. It's not even close to the same record. As a matter of fact, every song speaks volumes about where we've come and how territorial we are, where we're going. All the bells and whistles included, and we didn't leave any stone unturned then. So I think it says that. I think it speaks about itself.
Now, every record obviously is personal, and how much different was it writing this record, with sobriety and all that kind of stuff?
Well, to me, that was the biggest part, was going back to my roots and to remember that music has been the universal language for me and has been therapy as well as a family member from as long as I can remember, and that it didn't take alcohol for me to love music or to be passionate about it. You know, Rob Zombie said it best, dude. You can't be crazy without drugs or alcohol. You can't be crazy. And so that's really the mentality I went at it with. How much do I love this? How big of a passion do I still have in my heart to write records? And how much of myself am I still willing to expose? And being sober, the answer was all of it. You know what I mean? This is the first thing I've written since I got sober over 2 years, close to a little over 2 years ago. So for me, this was a big deal. It was not only therapy, but again, it was like shedding skin and becoming who I need to be and not who everybody thought I was meant to be.
I was going to say therapeutic, of course. Obviously, I hear it all the time from guys that are writing records and stuff, how therapeutic it is. And, you know, and you made a conscious effort to put yourself out there, eh?
Oh, my God. My chest was fully open, my friend. Yeah. Like, there was no holding back on this. I figured love it or hate it. I mean, just like the first lines in Inside Out, that's really my mentality, the whole record, and that's why we started with that song. As heavy as it is, we knew that there were going to be some stations. By the way, thank you for playing it.
Yeah, you're welcome.
They weren't going to be accepting of it. They were going to be like, oh, it's too aggressive, and this, that's got F-bombs in it. And for me, and for especially for Zoe and Kevin and Jason, we sat there and went, listen, have we ever really written anything to please other people? Again, the answer is no. So the reality of it is, what's going to make us happy? How do we want to go out this? And do we want to punch them in the face or just slap them on the butt? it was a no-brainer.
So was it a conscious effort to make this the heaviest album you guys have done so far?
No, I mean, it was just what came naturally. Mm. You know, emotions are there. Whether it's aggro or passionate and loving, it's just what the song called for. You know, it wasn't about, oh, I think I'm going to try to make this one a friendship, and I think I'm going to be a little pissed off. Like, if you hear the song Bottom of the Top, it absolutely shows you exactly what I'm talking about. The first line, you know, is this heavy enough for you? I got so sick and tired of people pigeonholing me and saying that I wasn't aggressive like Corey, I wasn't as sonically inspired. Like, you know what I mean? There was just so many questions that I got tired of answering. The reality of it is, myself and my band, we stand on our own 2 feet, and it was just going to be what it was. So it didn't, whether the song called for it to be a screamer, I guess you'd say, or if it just called for something a little bit more tongue-in-cheek and mellow, you know, it was really just what felt natural, my man. I didn't want to force feed anything.
Now, of course, this record's F8, Fate. Do you obviously believe in fate?
I do.
Yeah.
On all levels, yeah. I don't believe anything is coincidence. I really don't. It's a personal thing, but, you know, Zoe is in the same mindset. And we sat back, and again, we were talking about how we met. I mean, think about this. You have a kid who grew up in a communist country in Hungary.
Yeah.
All right, who came all the way. He could have gone to Europe or Russia or anywhere. No. He chose to get a backpack, a guitar, and a pocket full of money and come to the Mecca, New York, then go to L.A., and then he meets some skater kid from Colorado with an F-U attitude. And I mean, what are the odds? This is all fate and line. So, and it just happened to me, this is the greatest part, is when I was talking to him about how fate was involved with all this. He came back, he's like, you know what's incredible? That this is our eighth album. We're going to call it Five Finger Death Punch 8, but we're going to abbreviate it to F8. And I was like, dude, you're a genius. Like, how did I get so lucky? Like, this guy's just amazing.
Yeah.
Again, it was fate. It just all fell in place, as it should.
No, he's got an unbelievable story. Hey, a couple more things here for you outside of the record. Somebody want to know about your CBD line and what's up with that?
Rudy's Medicinals, my man.
Yeah.
Yeah, you don't sound so enthusiastic. Have you tried it?
I haven't, but the girl who writes all of our stories for the website here at the radio station, all of our stations, she wanted to expound on your CBD line.
I appreciate that. No, don't sound so underwhelmed, my friend. Big deal.
No, I believe it is. I'm not in that world, but you are, so go ahead.
Well, the whole thing of it is, it not only helped me through my sobriety with CBD and THC products, a lot of these new products that are coming out, people have jumped on wagons. You know, they're like, well, let's cash in while we can. It's a big deal. Everybody's vibing it. There's money to be made. For me, it had nothing to do with that. And that's from my heart, dude. Like, this was from the ground up, my idea, laboratory proven and tested. I mean, I went to the extreme to make sure this was the best product I could put my name on. And again, it's something I use on the road constantly. If you notice, none of my products have alcohol in them. They're all very natural. You know, it's organic. So there was a lot of things that went entail with this. And so that's something that I am, you know, completely, yeah. It's mind-boggling to me that years and years later, you know, when I was in junior high school, I'd get suspended for smoking weed.
Right.
And here I am, you know, 20 years later, and I'm going, hey, man, how you doing?
Yeah, but you're helping other people, too.
For sure, and that's another part of it, man. It's a natural form. You know, it's not... I had a counter full of medications when I first got out of recovery. All right. And anybody else who's been through any kind of surgery is one, you know exactly what I'm talking about. And it got to a point where I was like, I don't need this. I don't need this. I don't need this. Why the hell am I taking that? And so for me, it started, you know, I had to develop something that worked for me. And natural things have always been in line. You know, my mother was, I grew up kind of farm area in Colorado. And we were very, I'm going to call it garden friendly. So these things just all went in line, man. So Moody's Medicinals are a huge deal for me. I mean, I'm very, very proud of it and where it's going.
Well, that's cool.
Tell her I said thank you for bringing it up.
You got it. You're welcome. And congratulations on that. Final thing here for you. We're just talking about you've been around, you know, 12, 13 years. I walk by this poster every day at work, and it's from you guys. It's of you guys, I should say, like in 2010 or something. I mean, just young guys getting in. Do you feel like you've made it now?
No, God, no. That's like asking. That's like asking Deadpool if he's a superhero. No, just feels icky. I don't ever want to think I've made it.
All right,
seriously. Like, if I do, I mean, what's to come after that? I mean, made it. What does that even mean? Like, I've got a bidet now. It's to wipe my own ass. Like, it just. No, man, I haven't made anything yet, brother. I'm still on the up and up.
Well, I look at that poster every day, and I remember meeting you guys for the first time in a record store outside Detroit here, and now you guys are playing the Little Caesars Arena coming up with Papa Roach and I Prevail, and Megadeth is opening for you. I mean, that sounds like made it to me, but you know.
Hey, man, there's always bridges to be crossed, my friend, but I appreciate you saying that.
That is true. Well, Ivan, congratulations on the record, your CBD line, and all the things that you've done, your sobriety and everything else. You're an inspiration to many, and we'll see you here in the spring, and thanks so much for the time.
Hey, man, you take care of yourself. And, hey, by the way, next time, let's make a little circle and we can go out in the audience again. I think I had a better time than most of those people did. Fantastic.
I'm down, dude. Your security guys even contacted me and said, that was the craziest thing. Thanks for playing along. I'm like, all right, you're welcome. So
glad I could be a part of it, my man.
Ivan, right, thank you so much, man.
All right, be well.
Up next, it's author John Wiederhorn. He wrote this book, Raising Hell, Backstage Tales from the Lives of Metal Legends. He's also written some other books, which we get into in this conversation. But if you've ever wondered what it's like to be in a touring rock band, this book has many a story. As a matter of fact, I talked to Ross, the boss from Manowar, a couple weeks back, and he's got some stories in there, which we did talk about in the podcast, where he almost got sliced and diced by some real swords they were using on stage during a show somewhere overseas. But there are some great stories in this book. And John joins me right now on the Talkin' Rock with Meltdown podcast.
Things are good. Thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, no problem. Raising Hell, Backstage Tales from the Lives of Metal Legends. I was telling you before we started that I don't really spend a whole lot of time reading. I'm super busy, and to be quite honest with you, I can't really sit down and just, you know, read stuff all the time. But I found this book really interesting, especially if you see, you know, first of all, you got all the different chapters, you know, the groupies and the Spinal Tap moments and different things like that. But you can actually zoom in on some of your favorite rock artists. And then I guess my first question, and probably obvious ones you get a lot of times, is how do you get all these guys to talk about some of this backstage antics and some of the stuff that goes on with their lives?
Well, I've had a good relationship with a lot of these artists, having been, you know, doing this for the past 25 years. Everybody who's in the book has been interviewed for a previous story I've written for something, at least one story. I mean, I've interviewed Judas Priest 7 or 8 times and have a great relationship with them, so, and their manager. So fortunately, they were willing to come to the table, as was Corey Taylor of Slipknot. So I was able to get a lot of the names I really wanted. And the key to it really was to point out that this wasn't supposed to be a tell-all or a throw-anyone-under-the-bus kind of book. It's just supposed to be a celebration of heavy metal and the heavy metal lifestyle and some of the crazy stories that happen that band members usually sit around and talk to each other about when they're not, often years after they get back together or whatever, or after they've been apart for a while. So, you know, it's all campfire stories. Everyone was sent a list of the chapter titles, not the specific questions, but the chapter titles that I wanted to address. So people knew that there were going to be questions about alcohol and drugs and groupies and near-death experiences and Spinal Tap and, you know, insane accidents, driving and whatnot. Some people didn't want to talk about a certain subject, and that was fine. We just moved on to the next.
So hang on for a second. So did you actually, like, email people or text people the subjects, and then they responded to you? Or did you do these interviews in person, or kind of a mix of both?
No. I just, in advance, I sent them the list of the chapter titles.
Okay.
So I was like, okay, this is what I want to do with the book. You know, it's going to be a celebration of metal, just a bunch of great stories about metal from everybody in the genre from the 60s to the present day, but not arranged as any sort of a history, just categorized by these different kind of metal activities or mannerisms. So then I got them all on the phone. I actually didn't do any of these in person. These were all phone interviews, but still, it's over 125 names in there, so it was a lot of phone time. I'm glad they don't charge by the minute anymore.
Yeah, that's right. You talked about throwing people under the bus, and there was one thing. I was reading the book through, and first of all, well, before I get too much into this, I thought the stuff from Sam Rivers from Limp Bizkit was unbelievable. I didn't realize he had a liver transplant. I mean, he had just gone off the deep end so hard and so fast, and I guess he had a liver transplant in 2017. I mean, I don't keep up on the Limp Bizkit news, I suppose, but I thought that was remarkable. And if I'm not mistaken, I think it was him that was talking about back around, it might have been an Ozfest date or something like that, where him and Justin Chancellor were doing drugs from Tool. And I was thinking to myself, I wonder if Justin Chancellor knows that this is out there. You know, I wonder if, how many of the guys that, did you have to get permission from guys that perhaps you weren't talking to but were talked about in the book to kind of put them in there?
No, only if something was potentially litigious. If Justin Chancellor had never, ever talked about doing drugs in the past, and suddenly here's a musician talking about getting high with Justin, then, yeah, it could be potentially a problem, and we'd contact him. But if something's pretty understood that this is part of the mannerisms of their history, it's part of their behavior, and it's part of rock and roll, then you know, we went with it without having to vet anything. These guys are public figures, most of them, so you really do have to prove a lot, or they have to prove a lot to have any sort of legal case against you. But again, I wanted to make sure that there really wasn't malicious stuff that would malign someone's reputation. And I don't really think there's anything in there that's defaming, is defamatory or libelous. But the Sam Rivers thing, it's cool that you brought that up, because I talked to him and he was very forthcoming about a lot of stuff, and we did talk about shenanigans and wild stories. He's like, dude, I just don't remember that much of it because I was so drunk during all of that, which is kind of a typical excuse from someone who doesn't want to talk about their stuff.
Right.
And he's like, no, I'm serious, man. I had a major problem. And then he opened up about how his excessive drinking caused his liver damage. And he had to have a liver transplant. And he's like, man, I've never told anyone this. And then he proceeded to tell me the story. And, in some detail. And I'm like, wow, this is heavy stuff. And thank God he survived it, but he almost didn't. Like, he almost died on the operating table. So knowing, I'd interviewed him 6 months before the book came out, because there's long lead times before books come out. And I didn't ask him for any exclusive because, it's his story and his life. And had I been doing a story for a magazine specifically on that, I would have, said, hey, can we have the exclusive on this? So I figured, oh, this will come out in Billboard or Loudwire or some other outlet. And, that's fine. But didn't. It was a secret until Raising Hell came out. And because of that, there was an awful lot of press that was generated. There were a lot of outlets that were like, oh my God, I didn't know this about Sam. So a lot of metal sites and even non-metal sites, wrote about what he had been through. And I really like that kind of a story, because, it's a cautionary tale, really. I mean, there's a lot of celebration of decadence in this book, but there's also a fair amount of explaining the consequences of your actions, especially in the drugs chapter. What do we call it? Take as needed for pain.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Which was named after an I Hate God song and an album. But so in that chapter especially, there were some people who were very forthcoming about their drug use and their heroin abuse, and pretty much laid it on the line saying, if I didn't get through this and stop using, I'd either be out of the band or dead.
Well, I'll tell you what, David Ellison's a friend of mine, and knowing him now, and not really knowing him back in the day, but knowing him now, I'm thinking, drugs? Come on now, this is David Ellison. But yeah, he opened up about it. And there's a lot of it with Al Jorgensen from Ministry. And I have friends of mine who have partied with Al Jorgensen, and I've met Al Jorgensen a few times. And there's a couple things that strike me about Al. First of all, Al is a really good interview, I've always found.
Yeah.
But outside of that, it sounds like he's just a total mess. And he was really forthcoming about all of his experiences.
Yeah, I have a great relationship with Al. I had interviewed him numerous times in the past through the course of Ministry's career. And then I was doing an interview with him for my first book. It was for Louder Than Hell, my first book, which came out 7 years ago, which was more of a straightforward oral history about metal from the 60s to the present, all told in the voices of the artist. And that's really where I got the idea to tell just a bunch of crazy stories and not histories of bands. But I'm interviewing Al, and he's telling me these wild, hysterical stories, and he kind of laughs. He's like, man, I've got stories that would just have you pissing yourself. They're so much better than these, and I'd love you to come to El Paso and hang out with me, and I'll talk to you about them, but you can't write about them. I'm like, dude, what a great offer, but I think I end up with a divorce if I flew to Texas to party and didn't have any work to do out of the whole scene. I was like, but you know what, man, the minute that you want to write a book, I would love to be there, and I'd love to talk to you. He's like, you know what? Let me put you on with my manager. Let's talk about it. And it happened.
Right.
And, so about a year and a half after my first book came out, I got to do Al Jorgensen's autobiography with him, which is just a roller coaster ride of insanity. And there's a little bit of redemption at the end. I mean, he absolutely did kick all heavy drugs, and he quit alcohol for a long time. And I'm not sure if he's drinking now, but there have been times. But he's absolutely true to himself. And what makes him such an interesting interview, and what makes a lot of the guys in Raising Hell cool and in my book and people I wanted to talk to, was that they're self-deprecating, they're funny, and they're smart. So if they're talking about, you know, some crazy incident with a groupie or some wild experience throwing up on another rock star or whatever, they'll make it funny. And I knew that these stories would be, you know, more than just little anecdotes about, yeah, I hooked up with this girl in Michigan one night and, you know, she was so great. And then we got back on the bus and went to the next town. You know, 'cause that's not a story.
That's not. And, you know, Don Jameson was telling me about your book with Al Jorgensen. And he goes, yeah, you look at Motley Crue's book, The Dirt. It looks like, you know, it looks like a Disney ride compared to Al Jorgensen. I can completely believe that. But you talk about, like, you know, rock stars throwing up on other rock stars and different things, which did happen. Somebody threw up on Eddie Vedder.
Yes.
In the book, yeah. And
Max Cavalera.
Yep, that's right. And, yeah, because he wanted an autograph for his sister or something. She always said to get him an autograph. And, but anyways, I'll tell you, without giving away too much here, because it's kind of disgusting, but one of the most disgusting things in the book I found was Dino from Fear Factory. And you know where I'm going with this?
Oh yeah.
And the girl that, you know, satisfied all the roadies and everything. I'm like that is the most disgusting thing. And it takes a lot to, like, kind of offend me or, you know, appall me, but it was I'm like, you gotta be kidding me.
And the way it ends too.
Right.
Yeah. It's a pretty outrageous story. Dino's a great guy.
Right.
I can't condone all of his, you know, activities, but he was like a Gene Simmons with the ladies, man. You know, when
I found
really peaking in the 90s, he wasn't married. He was, like, fine about, you know, just scooping up whatever he could score for the night, and you know, wasn't shy about talking about experiences with twosomes and threesomes and moresomes but he didn't drink and he didn't smoke weed either, so that was sort of his outlet. A lot of these guys have to kill time, you know. They've got hours and hours between shows and tons of time on the bus. So when they arrive somewhere, there's a hurry up and wait scenario, and they've got tons of alcohol waiting for them on their rider, and it's easy enough for them to hook up with drugs if that's what their thing is. So, you know, the rock and roll lifestyle really feeds this type of activity, and for better or worse, some can contain it and know when to say when, and then a lot can't. But I think a lot of this behavior, even the shenanigans, the pranks that are pulled with, you know, there's some crazy stuff with Richard Christie, who's the master of feces. And in one venue, he pooped in a coffee can and stuck it in an oven that was in the, you know, so of course there's this stench of burning and smoke coming out. But as he, you know, again, a hysterical guy, a really nice guy, and he just had these crazy stories from the past. He's like, God, we got bored, man, and we did some really stupid things.
Well, you know, that's the thing. It's like, I'll never forget, Brad Arnold from Three Doors Down was telling me one time, he goes, and this was on an interview, I'm not talking out of school, but he's like, yeah, dude, I just became an alcoholic because, you know, you got 20, 22 hours to kill every day, and it's like, what am I going to do? Well, I can drink this over here, and it's like, and that's what he was doing. He told me, he goes, I was just bored on tour, and now when he goes to a new town, he tries to find something to do. And you know it's funny how all these guys, you've been in this business a long time just like I have, and you meet these guys and they're just like a drug alcohol infested mess, and next thing you know they all got kids, they're sober, they're doing P90X. it's like you can see the transformation in a lot of these guys. Like you're just talking about Al Jorgensen, I mean, you know, just like that.
Right. Yeah, he's a little bit more of an extreme character than a lot. But
right.
You know, Dave Ellis is a perfect example.
Right,
he was
exactly
a junkie,
yep,
and he turned his life around, got married, had kids, became a devout Christian. And it's a way to kind of move on, I guess. Matt Hafey from Trivium got his partying out of the way when he was young, and then one day he did what was actually regarded as one of the band's best and most groundbreaking shows in England at Download Festival. But he was coked up out of his mind. He said he couldn't sing, and he sounded like shit, and his nose was bleeding before he went up. And he decided then and there that, you know, I'm either going to devote myself to a career in music or I'm just going to be a fuck-up. Oops, don't know if I can say
no,
that.
No, yeah, you're fine, you're fine. No, but, right. No, but you're right. It's like these guys, it all seems, and I've asked a lot of these guys, like, what was your come to Jesus moment? And they all have one, you know?
Yeah.
And that was his.
He said, so he now goes from town to town wherever they play. He finds a couple hours to go sightseeing and then to go to a restaurant. He's become a huge foodie. So he always looks for a different type of cuisine in any new city he arrives in, which I thought was pretty interesting and nice. Because a lot of these guys have addictive behaviors, you know. They have this compulsive drive.
Yep.
And part of it goes along with being a musician, is that need to create constantly. So when you take away the booze or the drugs or whatever is compulsive for them, they often have to find something else. You know, be it writing, like Corey Taylor writes like a fiend from Slipknot. Mm-hmm. And he does 100 different things. It's pretty amazing how he's refueled his addictive drives. But, you know, it's tough because it's so easy to relapse. It's so easy because you're in that environment. And it's encouraged, you know, when you've got riders that have tons of booze on them. I mean, look at James Hetfield. You know, he seems to be fine now, but last year, you know, he wound up back in rehab because he was overdoing it, and I'm guessing he was just so overwhelmed by the constant attention and the constant push that you know Metallica was making to continue to be the biggest metal band of all time. And that's a lot of hard work. It has a lot of, you know, it must take its toll.
And it's like, here's the thing. It's like everybody wants to party with rock stars, right? But it's like when you're partying with a rock star on a Tuesday night, he's doing the same thing for the next 6 nights with different people in different cities while you're going to bed at 10 o'clock and waking up and going to work the next day.
Yeah. Pantera used to say that. They were like, you know, we didn't want to party every night, but we didn't want to disappoint our fans.
Exactly, yeah. God, I heard so many stories because VP was a friend of mine, and I heard so many Dimebag stories. So many of my friends have stories of Dimebag, like, you know, pounding on their tour bus door at 8 a.m. with like a tray of shots. They're like, dude, we just went to bed like 3 hours ago. And he's like, get up, man, come on. You know, you can't drink all day if you don't start in the morning. That whole thing, you know how, you know, Dime was.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
You know,
oh,
Rex yeah. and Phil had their stories, and Phil's actually told me about his bad back, and that was in there. Scott Ian, I've heard that story about him meeting Lemmy from Motorhead. The Motorhead stories are so funny. When Lemmy lands at an airport and he goes to the liquor store, buys a 2 liter of pop and a fifth of Jim Beam and pours half the pop out and just puts a Jim Beam in there. It's hysterical stories, you know. And it's like, you know, and I'd never met Lemmy. I always wanted to. I actually went to Los Angeles once, and I went right to the Rainbow Room there or whatever it was, and I'm like, I gotta meet Lemmy. He wasn't there that day, of course, but it's like just the stories and the stuff is just so fantastic. So was there any guys that you wanted to get in the book that you couldn't for whatever reason?
Well, there were some guys. Yeah, I would have loved to get some Metallica.
You got a little bit of Kirk in there a little bit with Gary Holt and stuff. Yeah,
a little bit, but they're a hard sell. And,
right.
And you know, fortunately, Gary Holt was super helpful and, you know, was willing to do the intro for the book, which really sets up everything, because he's another one of these people who Exodus were insane as teenagers.
Yes.
In the emerging San Francisco thrash scene. And, you know, they were violent and crazy, and they'd trash people's houses, like, without thinking twice. And he, you know, not that he regrets what he did when he was a kid, but he looks back and he's like, God, man, that was not a cool thing to do. Why do we do that? All this, you know, fueled by this crazy youth and the speed of metal and you know, whatever substances they were taking. But cleaned up. A lot of these guys, you know, they become adults and they have kids, and then they do clean up, as you said, and that's when they're willing to tell their stories often, unless they don't want the wife and kids to find out certain things and think badly of them. But
and in Gary's case, you become a vegan.
That's right. That was great.
As a lot of them do,
you don't even eat meat?
I know, and I know Gary a little bit. You know, it's funny, David Olveson was here in the station one day, and we were just kind of walking around, and he saw this picture of Gene Simmons on the wall. And for whatever reason, he started telling me this story about going over to Kerry King's house, and his dad was like a cop, and his mom was like, I don't know, a stay-at-home mom or whatever. And he's like, yeah, and Kerry's in the background, you know, in the backyard, you know, nailing down pentagrams on boards. And then I start reading stuff, and they're talking about growing up and going to Kerry's. I'm like, this is hysterical because I heard all this stuff. And
right,
it's like,
right.
I didn't realize these guys. I mean, I knew that they all came from like the same kind of, you know, the thrash scene. But these guys like grew up with each other and knew each other. You know, it's unbelievable.
Yeah. Well, Kerry King played with Megadeth when they were trying to
find
a guitarist at one point.
Yep.
And he did a few gigs with them, and then he, you know, wanted to put his priorities into Slayer, and I think Megadeth also were going, you know, slightly different types of players. But they were all, you know, they were all friends until they weren't.
Yeah. Yeah. Hey, give me some stories or some people that kind of surprised you in what they had told you or what they had done.
Well, I knew that this guy from a band called Deceased named King Fowley was an outrageous character, which is why I, you know, chose him for the book. He's a legend in that within the thrash and death metal scene, he's a real character, and that's how I defined a legend, not someone who sold 10 million records, and someone who's also totally true to themselves. Like pretty much, I think pretty much everybody in the book, I think, is very, very driven and motivated by the music they make, and isn't just in it for a cash grab. And you know, someone like Lemmy, he lived it, you know.
Right.
He lived it on stage, he lived it off stage. He was so true to himself. So, you know, this guy King Fowley from Deceased, I knew would open up about stuff. But the graphic nature that he approached his stories with when talking about, you know, being just wasted out of his face on PCP in the middle of the woods with friends trying to find the tent again, and then feeling like he was swimming through, you know, jello, and then the even nastier stuff about groupies, and he was just another huge, huge guy. What is it with these like 400-pound guys who are just sex magnets? I don't get it. And Dave Windor from Monster Magnet.
Oh, he has great stories.
He was,
yeah,
big with the ladies. But so King Fowley told me some really, really graphic sexual stories, and you know, had no compunction about having him in the book. And one involves this girl that he didn't want to be with, one of the few. And he said, "Man, I'm not going to be with you unless you have sex with a chicken." And she's like, "Well, you know, okay." And then she went out and purchased some Purdue chicken parts.
Oh my God!
And proceeded to take frozen chicken pieces and use them in a way that perhaps Zeppelin might have back in the Mud Shark days.
Yeah, the Mud Shark. Yeah. No, it's hysterical. The book is killer, man. I love the stories, and it's just like a real great background look. And I guess for me, knowing some of these guys in the book and having interviewed some of them and knowing some of them personally, like I said, it's like kind of wild to hear some of these stories. So, and I want everybody to go back and check out your Louder Than Hell book. I haven't had a chance to dig into this one, but I hear it's great, and I got to get into that as well. And that came out, what, 6-7 years ago?
Yeah, that was my first book. It was 7 years ago, and kind of set me on this path. And it was that book that laid the groundwork for Raising Hell. You know, between it, I'd done these authorized biographies from, you know, I mentioned Al Jurgensen, but I also did Scott Ian's, which was really great. He's such a great guy.
Yes, he is.
And Roger Moret from Agnostic Front. They did his book too. And I'd love to do another book in that vein as my next venture. But all along I thought, wow, what if I just had a bunch of great crazy stories and it was just this love letter to metal fans, you know, just, you know, I mean, every metal fan loves Spinal Tap. So what about a great story, about, chapter about just all the Spinal Tap type moments that musicians have had? And that's one of my favorite chapters in the book. There's some really funny stuff in there. And I just wanted it to be entertaining, you know, funny and outrageous, but also, you know, harrowing and terrifying at times, too. There's just some stuff in there, like especially with Baroness John Baisley from Baroness and the bus crash that could have killed all of them.
It's
wild stuff.
Yeah, the stories are just mind blowing. Some of them, and it's just really good stuff. Well, John, thanks so much for your time. Raising Hell: Backstage Tales from the Lives of Metal Legends. We could talk about this for another 3 hours, but I appreciate your time, and it's a great read. And thanks for contacting me, and thanks for the conversation.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, and I'm really glad you enjoyed the book.
John Wiederhorn, like I said, Raising Hell: Backstage Tales from the Lives of Metal Legends is available right now. Definitely get that book if you're looking to see how things are done behind the scenes. Hey, it's Meltdown. Thank you so much for checking out the Talking Rock with Meltdown podcast. Got to thank Ivan Moody and all the time he gave me, as well as John. Two just great conversations that you guys can take in, and I do appreciate that. Hey, listen, subscribe to the podcast. I've got a bunch of interviews already lined up for next week. I talked about this already. Joe Satriani is one of them. Tom Kiefer from Cinderella, one of my all-time favorites, is going to be on the show coming up here in the next couple of weeks as well. So if you get a chance, like I said, subscribe, five-star reviews, five-star ratings. You can write reviews as well on Apple and iTunes. That always helps as well to push us out to different people around the globe. So we do appreciate that too. But of course, as always, thank you so much for listening. Until we do it again next time.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most fans of country music, we're excited to learn that Luke Combs was back in the studio working on his next album. We've come up with our list of iconic Luke Combs music videos. Yes, Lovin' on You made the cut. Text Luke to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Luke to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.